Welcome to episode 6 of Comic Timing, a comics podcast devoted to the average comic book fan from the average comic book fan. Join in as David Price and myself, Ian Levinstein, discuss whatever comes to mind time after time here on Comic Timing. This week, David and I are joined by John Wally Wallbecker as we go through some of the top stories of the week and give our honest opinion on the third X-Men film, X-Men: The Last Stand. My main question, where did the 3 go in that title? Ah, well. Here now, the host of our show, myself, Ian Levinstein.
Hey folks, my name's Ian Levinstein, and welcome to Comic Timing. Now, right off the bat here, I will be the host of Comic Timing for the foreseeable future, at least, as Toby Cook has officially left the show. He's got some personal problems he's got to deal with, so if he ever, you know, feels like coming on back, the invitation is open to him, but he feels it's best off for him to leave the show for now. So, Toby, thanks for getting us together in the first place, and we hope to continue this show in your image. Anyway, let's get things rolling here. I am joined, as always, by the Man of a Thousand Podcast, David Price.
Hello, all.
Hello, hello, and joining us this week, he is a man of action, he is a man of honor, he is a man of duty, and he joined me once before on Geek Speak. He is Jonathan Wally Wallbecker.
Thank you very much.
We're off to a great start already. Well, let's get things rolling here. We'll start off with some news to get things going. Now, the big news coming out this week, pretty slow week when it comes to news, even though Wizard World Philly is going on right now. Haven't really been any announcements coming out of there. But we do have the announcement that Ed McGuinness is heading over to Marvel. He has been basically a mainstay of DC Comics for a long time now, but he will be coming over to Marvel Comics, and he previously did work on Deadpool. He did a pretty good job when he was on Deadpool, and now he'll be working with Marvel again. There is planned in the future yet another collaboration between him and Jeff Loeb, but they're obviously keeping that under wraps for now. Now, David, in the past, have you enjoyed Ed McGuinness's work?
I have enjoyed what I did read of Ed McGuinness's work. I do have a couple issues of Superman. One in particular was during the whole, I think it was either the Joker's Last Laugh storyline. It was Superman versus Doomsday, and he does a really good job when there are larger than life characters in the book. I do like his style. There are some things that I find he does a little quirky that I'm really not a big fan of, but I think he'll do pretty well. Like I said, regardless of what company he works for, as long as he can work on characters that are already big and bulky, then I think he'll always have a job.
So in other words, you want him on the Hulk.
I would love to see him on the Hulk. I think he'd do pretty good on Thor. But yeah, I could see the Hulk. Absolutely.
Well, if anybody remembers, it's because of his drawing of Thor that basically got him work in the first place. He was one of the winners of Wizard's artist contest back in the day, back when they used to run those. I think they still do, but he was one of the first winners of that. And if I remember correctly, it was a Thor sketch that actually drew the attention of a lot of the comic book folks out there and basically got him work.
Okay.
So, you know,
I forgot all about that, yeah.
As did I until you were speaking, and I'm like, wait a minute, he drew Thor before. Oh, yeah, there you go. So that works with that. Wally, how about you? Are you a fan of Ed McGuinness?
As a self-professed Marvel zombie, it warms the cockles of my heart when a DC mainstay comes to Marvel with an exclusive deal. Yeah, I like it. He's a good artist. There's more Marvel characters that he will fit in with than our DC characters. There's less of a chance of him to make, you know, fugly women and thick, thin guys, but I definitely would like to see him on some of the solo characters that are in the Marvel Universe. Don't want to see him do any teams, though.
Really? So you wouldn't want to see him on somebody like the Avengers or something like that?
Is there something about the style that I don't think he can do the variety in body styles well enough? Not that.
Okay.
It's just when you see a picture of like a team pose of something he's drawn, they all look very similar, plus or minus a few inches.
Absolutely.
You know, when you're, especially with New Avengers, you've got Spider-Man, you've got Wolverine, you've got Captain America. These are all completely different body styles that look best when they're drawn as such.
Well, you know, recently, actually, in his last Superman-Batman arc with Jeff Loeb, he drew, what were they, like the Maximums or something like that? Obviously, you know, a complete clone of the Ultimates. And you could say they're very, very close to what the Avengers look like and what the Ultimates look like. And he did a decent job on that, but I can sort of agree with you that his body types are his main issue, because everybody seemed to be the same height and similar builds. Even their version of Hawkeye, that version of Hawkeye had, like, so many muscles on him, it was absolutely crazy.
And they made action figures from his drawings.
The action figures I liked, actually. The Superman-Batman action figures. Well, my favorite one was the exclusive, the one with Superman with the half-ripped Shazam costume on the outside, which was from one of the very early arcs of Superman-Batman. Those I really enjoy. His art transfers well over to, like, a cartoon or an action figure medium. But in a comic book, it can be a bit shaky sometimes.
Okay.
You know, again, that's another thing. Maybe he might want to look into doing more figures. You know, he might be a good, like, maybe sculptor or designer when it comes to sculptures, but I'm not quite sure sequential artwork is 100% for him.
I'm a fan of Ed McGuinness headshots. I'm a fan of Ed McGuinness as long as he's not drawing fists or overdeveloped thighs.
Ouch.
Everybody looks really chunky. And I mean, and for a lot of his characters, that works. He was really good on Superman. But when I read JLA Classified, those first three issues, and I see Wonder Woman or somebody that's not Superman or a gorilla, things are looking a little askew. But I know that he had his run on Deadpool with Marvel, and I think his style was a little bit different, although kind of you could see where he ended up today back then. I mean, I don't pick up a book because Ed McGuinness did the art on it. He would have to be working with a writer or a character that I really like.
And I definitely agree that he does certain characters better than some. And I think he'll be well fitted in the Marvel Universe. There's more characters that.
Yeah. Fit as long as you keep him away from Spidey.
Yeah.
Nothing frail.
Right.
I don't want to see him draw Gambit.
Yeah. Oh, God. He would break Gambit. He would break Gambit in half.
He's sort of like Rob Liefeld with talent.
Ooh. Oh. 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 Oh man! Usually I'm the one making the Liefeld references. This is too much. Yeah, because I mean, like, you can only do so many panels that look exactly the same to do something like that, you know. And his Superman work was good. I'll definitely say that. His initial run with Loeb on the Superman titles, Joker's Last Laugh. Yeah, that was really, really fun, I gotta say. I mean, that was one of my favorite Superman arcs growing up as a kid, basically having, you know, the entire world, you know, like, all insane and, like, under the Joker's rule. That was great. And he did great artwork on that. It did sort of prove, also, he can draw other people if, you know, put on the proper book, but I'm not quite sure how he'll do. So, any particular Marvel characters you wanted to stay away from? I know that you mentioned Spider-Man, David. Any others?
Captain America, I don't think.
Really?
Yeah, I don't. Because as broad shoulders as the man is, I don't think we need the huge thighs and the super huge broad shoulders.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to see him on Spider-Woman. I wouldn't want to see him on X-Men. It's easier to say that I'd just rather see him on Hulk or Thor than list all the books that I really wouldn't want to see him on.
So, only certain icons, not all of them.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Because, you know, I've always thought of Cap to be sort of larger than life, and, you know, you mentioned, you know, Cap as being one of those large, you know, I mean, Superman as being one of those larger than life
but
guys.
You don't want to give him the same body type of a shorter Hulk.
True. All right. Maybe he'll actually learn how to, like, maybe vary himself a bit while he's over at Marvel. Because, again, he's been working with the same guys for so long now. Maybe it just takes a bit of a change to maybe open up his artwork.
It could be. You know, maybe you're right. Maybe a change of scenery will you know, let things flow a little more freely or a little bit more loose. And he'll actually, you know, he'll surprise us, which I'm looking forward to. If he surprises me, then that's great. Then I'm all for it.
He also hasn't done a lot of work outside of Jeff Loeb. So, I mean, again, it might very well also depend on who's writing the book, because obviously the writer's going to give him directions on, you know, what sort of art to draw. And you know that Jeff Loeb loves the larger-than-life stuff. He always has. And teaming Ed McGuinness with Jeff Loeb is basically just saying, here, how larger-than-life do you want this? you know, and give him somebody like maybe like an Ed Brubaker, or give him somebody, you know, who is more grounded with the storytelling, and maybe his art will adapt that way. What do you think, Wally? I mean, do you think he might actually be able to adapt his style a bit?
I think he can. And he's obviously got talent, and anyone with talent should be able to adapt themselves. I would actually really, based on his style, like to see him do something with Dan Slott, because that's sort of almost cartoony style, over the top, and with the way Slott writes, I think that would be a really, really fun match. I mean, I would say The Thing, but that's gone. Maybe now that Slott has some more time, he can do something else. Maybe Speedball.
You know, Speedball, actually. Yeah. I'm not quite sure about that. I mean...
It's a zombie.
Oh, okay, I gotcha. So the sequel to Marvel Zombies with Speedball.
Speedball.
Brian Deemer, if you're listening, we apologize profusely for speaking Speedball's name in vain. And hopefully you'll forgive us. This is a perfect time to say that. Once again, happy birthday, belated birthday to Brian Deemer out there. Just got to say that very quickly.
Yes.
He is the man who has set us up with our forums. And I forgot to mention this at the top of the show. For those of you wondering what the hell happened to episode 5 who don't frequent our forums, and again, if you don't frequent our forums, please, we recommend doing so. Over at the Comic Geek Speak forums, we just have a brand new forum set up. It's only been there for a couple of weeks now. If you go to Comic Timing, if you sign up, you can basically be a part of the CGS community, be a part of as many of the different forums on there as possible. But episode 5, I had to reformat my hard drive, and in the process, episode 5 got lost. So you're going to have to wait to hear basically Amy's wonderful, wonderful voice again, because it's lost to the universe now. It's somewhere in like one of those alternate realities that the Exiles visit. Maybe it'll show up again someday. Maybe we'll sit down and re-record that episode someday. But it was about conventions, so that's certainly a topic we could talk about again someday. But for now, it's not there. So we're pulling in around comics, and we're going to basically skip episode 5 and just go straight to episode 6, which is exactly what this is. So there you go. Also, some other news that I just saw right here. We discussed in a previous episode that some books that we love were getting canceled. One of these was Manhunter. I had just started reading Manhunter. And it was a very interesting book, and as soon as I started reading it, what happened? It gets canceled. Well, it just got announced it's coming back for 5 more issues.
Now, okay, for 5 more issues, does that mean that it's just going to tie up the current storyline? You're just going to finish up whatever was already in the works? Or is this a rounded-up number, so it'll be like issue 25?
See, that's a very good question there, because, well, here's the story out of Newsarama, just so I can read it here. If its fans wailed and gnashed their teeth with the announcement that DC's Manhunter was ending with August issue 25, for a little over 2 years, writer Mark Andraco had been chronicling the life of a new hero, Kate Spencer, who, for her own reasons and motivations, took on the mantle of Manhunter in the DC Universe. The series was a cult favorite, its audience small, but widely devoted to the new heroine as she made her way in a world filled with costumes, heroes, villains, madmen, monsters, and Solomon Grundys. Okay, maybe not. During her run, the Manhunter legacy was explored, Kate made mistakes along her path, other heroes were met, and a network of supporting characters was fleshed out. The book won acclaim from virtually all corners, from fans to critics to Rob Liefeld, okay, maybe not, pros to other publishers. But in the end, it wasn't enough. Live by the numbers, die by the numbers. In the terms of right people thing, DC executive editor Dan DiDio, in the terms of action, think 5 more issues of Manhunter by the same creative team held by Mark Andraco. I've canceled a lot of books in my day, but the thing that struck me the most about Manhunter was that this was the most vocal and organized response that we've gotten to any other of our cancellations since I've been here, DiDio told Newsarama. It actually made me pause for a moment because Manhunter is a favorite of mine, and when I had to cancel it, it was really against my own personal choices. But when I saw the fan reaction ramp up, it was enough to make me think it might be worth it to go back and give this book another shot. Think of it as DC's Spider-Girling the series. Across the town, Marvel's Spider-Girl series consistently skirted the edges of cancellation, now only to come back time and again for limited runs as fans reacted to bolstered sales. Now it's Manhunter's turn. So Manhunter is coming back for at least 5 more issues, and there is a chance for it coming back for even more. Now, what's your take on that? Do you guys feel that it warrants coming back? Because I myself definitely do.
Go ahead, Wally.
I have no comment.
Really?
I don't know Manhunter. I've never read the book. First I heard of it was when someone was elated that it was coming.
Okay, now how about the fact that, well, let's just put this in general here. How about series that are teetering on the edge? I'm sure you've read plenty of series that, you know, ended up getting canceled before their time. Now, what do you think about the book getting canceled and then them coming back in a matter of weeks and saying, oh, on second thought, maybe we'll come back for some more issues? I mean, isn't that sort of playing with your emotions a bit?
The cynical side of me wants to think that that's just a publicity stunt. I mean, they're getting so much pub off this Manhunter thing now than they would have ever gotten if it just chugged along. Like, for instance, right now I know about it, and I wouldn't have otherwise known about it, and I'm interested to know more, not necessarily buy it yet, but I'm interested to know more because there was such a reaction. And I wouldn't put it past the company to do that, full well intending on not really canceling it, just giving it a break, let the fans rustle their feathers, get, you know, the news story about it being canceled and then it coming back, and whole bunch of pub for the book.
Well, it's, again, like what they mentioned, it's sort of like the Spider-Girl complex, because, I mean, as a Marvel fan, I'm sure you know, Wally, you know, Spider-Girl was teetering on the edge for so many frickin' times, and it ended up getting more and more readers to read it that way, you know. It's canceled. Oh, it's coming back. Wow, it must be worth it. I must start reading this immediately. And then you start reading it, then it gets canceled again, then it comes back, then it gets canceled again, then it comes back. You know, it's a pattern here.
Definitely. You could spot it a mile away. Like, with the Dan Slott's thing, which I've already mentioned once, and I promise, last time, except for when I mention it again
later. Pull my thing.
It is... I would not be surprised, honestly, if in a week or two, that they come back and said, oh, the fan reaction was so huge that we're going to bring it back for a few more issues, kind of, to see what's up. I'm cynical, what can I say, when it comes to that sort of thing. Until the book is dead, buried, and all the issues are in the back issue bins, then it's dead.
So, who knows? Maybe if they make a Speedball series, you know, maybe then... Okay, no more Speedball references. I'm sorry. That's just wrong of me. David, what about you? I mean, were you reading Manhunter? Have you ever read it?
No, I was not, unfortunately. This was a female Manhunter,
yes, this was a female Manhunter. It was a brand new character, basically, you know, with the Manhunter legacy, and they recently introduced into the series, this isn't really too much of a spoiler here, that she might have roots to other heroes in the DC Universe, such as the original Atom. Somewhere in her past, they're saying it might very well be her father, but they're not entirely sure at this point, but that she has some sort of roots to the Golden Age Atom, and they're trying to figure that out here also. So again, she's a character that's, you know, rooted in DC's past, even if she's a brand new character.
Or at least they're trying to, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Rooted or
retcon? Rooted.
Yeah.
I would say rooted, because there's not much of a retcon going on here, because again, it's just exploring...
Well, rooted in the century way, or...
That's a good question there, because, well, Century, a lot of people could say was retconned. You know, I mean, like, all this, you know, basically this entire character that we'd never really seen before that apparently, you know, was there all these years, but we didn't know about it and all that, that's a bit much.
So then I would... So then rooted in the Illuminati sense.
Yes. Yeah, that's okay. That's the way I'll put it there, because again, this is sort of the thing that, you know, she's been around, but, you know, then she finally happened to get her powers, and now we're finding more about her past, which might very well be rooted to the further past of DC, which is good, you know, honestly. I mean, I like characters that sort of have a history before they're even introduced into a book.
Okay.
I'll buy that.
Now, talking about what I just mentioned to Wally, I mean, David, do you feel that this is one giant publicity stunt here, or do you feel that they actually were going to cancel it and just got it back to the fan reaction?
They probably were going to cancel it. We don't hear from DC too often about them, you know, buckling due to overwhelming fan response. The time frame kind of makes me think maybe. I mean, I don't think anything was done on a publicity stunt level like Coke to New Coke. I don't think anything, you know, going back to Coke Classic would... It's not reaching those types
Avengers
of levels.
Avengers to New Avengers.
Yeah, see that... No, I'm not even going to get into that, but... No, I don't think it was too, I don't think it was designed to be a publicity stunt.
Okay. And one more piece of news here that actually ties into the main topic of the show, which we're going to get into soon. Well, for those of you who remember a little while back, Greg Pak did a miniseries about the Phoenix called Phoenix Endsong. Well, now he's coming back and writing yet another series about the Phoenix, X-Men Phoenix War Song, which is coming in September. And this time he's joined by Tyler Kirkham, who, with covers by Mark Silvestri, to explore just what was going on and why the Phoenix Force would approach the Cuckoos, who were a character introduced during the Morrison series. And honestly, I'm sort of happy to see this because I absolutely loved Phoenix Endsong when it was in there, and Greg Pak is definitely an up-and-coming writer that I want to see more from. Did any of you guys read his Phoenix Endsong the first time around?
No, I did not.
What about you, Wally?
Not the first time around, but I've read the trade since.
Okay, and what did you think of the trade?
I liked it. I've read a lot of Phoenix stories, being an X-Men fan. It's definitely up there, very well-crafted. It's news to me now, hearing that there's going to be Phoenix War Song, and the Cuckoos are definitely one of the very few bits of the Morrison run that I did like. So that's got my interest peaked.
Well, I mean, honestly, I am glad to see that they are exploring this more, because a lot of the stuff that was brought up in Phoenix Endsong hasn't really been touched since. You know, they put up a lot of different ideas in there, but the books, the main books, just sort of completely skirted over that, and that's something I really hate to see. You know, when a great idea is brought in, and then the main books completely ignore it whatsoever, or at least sweep it under the rug, which is something that Marvel does on a regular basis. I mean, I'd hate to say. David, have you ever read a miniseries that, you know, seemed as if it was going to mean something, and then you finally, you know, get into the regular books yet again, and you realize that, well, it was just a miniseries, and it just goes absolutely nowhere?
I'm trying to think if the Machine Man miniseries, the first one, if they ever went back and you know, tried to get anything from that miniseries to do something else. Are you referring to specific miniseries that
that
coincide with long running titles, or just, you know, a miniseries like that they just decide to put out and then they'll have a series something else later?
Well, I can think of about 12 Spider-Man miniseries off the top of my head that, you know, seemed as if they were actually going to mean something in the scheme of the regular books and ended up.
Oh, you could also say the same thing for any of the thousands of Batman miniseries.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a great thing to bring up, because they put so many of these out on a regular basis, and so little of them actually stay in continuity or mean something. And they're not said to be Elseworlds, and then you read it, and it means absolutely nothing in the regular book.
Right.
Which is, to me, that's really, like, leading us on, you know? And it's something that every company does, understandably, but, again, if you make a miniseries that makes it seem as if it's going to mean something, make it mean something.
Yeah.
Also, there have been some events in the past, also. Like, I'll think of Day of Judgment offhand. Because that actually, when it happened, you know, the thing that basically made Hal the Spectre back in the day, very little effect on the actual books that were going on. Except for Spectre, which launched out of that. But it was basically just one giant way to get Hal Jordan back into the DC Universe. And after that, nobody mentioned it in any of the regular books. Well, let's stop skirting around the issues here, and let's actually get into the main topic at hand here. And that, of course, would be X-Men 3. Now, we warn you, there are going to be a lot of spoilers in this here, so I highly recommend that if you have not seen X-Men 3, go see X-Men 3 and then listen to this episode, because we are going to give away a lot here. So, first of all, let's get the general temperature of the crowd here. I enjoyed it, but not nearly as much as I enjoyed X-Men 1 or X-Men 2. What are your guys' take on it? We'll start with you, Wally.
Definitely thumbs up. Definitely a fun movie, and definitely fits within the trilogy nicely, in my opinion. Not as good a film as X-Men 2 was. X-Men 2 is a very well-crafted film. X-Men 3 is a lot more entertainment than film, if you have an idea of the difference between the two. But I definitely enjoyed it. It was more watchable than the first one on a repeat viewing, and I definitely have them ranked 2, 3, 1 at the moment.
What about you, David?
I really, really, really liked it, and I'm not surprised that I liked it. I'm trying to. Wally's not the first person to say that number 2 was a better or stronger movie. Maybe I've just seen number 2 so many times, and number 3 is still fresh in my head that I'm trying to think what made number 2 so much better. I did like number 2. I liked 2 better than 1 when that came out. But I really liked this movie. There were a couple of things that I'll get into later that, looking back on it, if I had noticed when it was happening, might not have made it as good a movie for me, but I agree with Wally. I give it a thumbs up.
Now, one of the things that got me right off the bat is the fact that the trailers really made it seem as if Cyclops is going to have a major role in this movie, and, well, he kind of didn't after the first 5 minutes of the movie.
So you had 5 minutes where he had a really good role in the movie.
Yeah, but the fact remains that this is a guy that basically has been the head of the X-Men for the longest time in the comics and was one of the main focal points of 1 and 2. To have him just written off like that, right off the bat, really kind of irked me.
To be fair, he was not the main focal point of 2. He was written out in much the same way, minus dying. But, I mean, he was captured right away, and you don't see him again until...
Yeah, that's right.
Had his mind altered, and he's attacking Jean at the end of the film. The first one, big role, important role, focal role, but then they lost it in the second one, and I really don't blame the film for just continuing with what the second was doing. And I like the fact that you don't see him die. It's a comic book film, and he doesn't... You don't see the death. I don't buy that he's dead either. And that's what I like about it. It's like, okay, you wrote him off in much the same way that he was written off the last one, but you don't leave it so he can't come back.
Sure.
In a believable fashion.
Well,
so
he was doing Superman Returns at the time, so that's another thing. And also, gotta mention this, I love how those two movies traded directors. How Bryan Singer went to Superman Returns, and we got Brett Ratner for X-Men 3, and originally Brett Ratner was going to do Superman Returns, and Bryan Singer was going to do X-Men 3. It's like they traded each other for, you know, a player to be named later in some Gatorade.
Ultimately, I think that actually really ended up helping us as comic film fans, because I think Ratner wouldn't have made a very good Superman, but Singer is going to make a very good Superman. Whether or not it's a success is another question, but it will, quality-wise, be a very well-done film.
And Ratner had the well of the first two movies to go back to make a good comic book.
True.
Okay. So in the long run, we're going to have two movies that some, it's slightly more than the majority of the fans like, as opposed to one really great X-Men 3 and then one really bad Superman, which would have been kind of depressing. Even as a Marvel guy myself, I don't want to see Superman stuff.
Now, directing-wise, I mean, do you feel it was a well-directed movie? I mean, do you feel that the shot selection was actually, you know, on par and that, you know, he made good cuts and all that and that it was a well-directed movie?
Definitely. I think the thing with Ratner is he surrounds himself with the right people. The guy, the cinematographer whose name escapes me because it's got several different letters in it that aren't common in last names in America, it's very visual. It looks gorgeous. The effects definitely take it up a notch, and given the brief amount of post-production time they had, it's actually really impressive. And he was concluding Bryan Singer's thoughts with this film. He took Bryan Singer's vision of the first two and put a concluding end cap to them all. So it's really hard to judge his directorial vision based on the fact that he was trying to pay respects to someone else's vision.
Now, true.
But I give him credit. He did as good of a job as one could expect it, and he definitely is way better than the haters out there. And I don't even understand why people hate him. They're probably just jealous because he's very Joe Schmo looking, yet he dates supermodels and is very rich.
And he directs Jackie Chan, which actually, you know, that's something that a lot of people don't get to do in their lives.
See, I think Chris Tucker could have made a great addition to this movie because there's
no one.
You can't tell me that he's not a mutant.
David, oh God! Yeah,
seriously, if Chris Tucker was one of the mutants on the island, and they just stab Magneto with the cure, he's, you know, jumps up on right on top of Magneto like, you just got knocked out.
That's right.
Okay,
theater would have exploded.
Okay, that's it. I'm sorry to announce it on the same episode of Toby's leaving. David's going to be leaving as well, but no. No. In all seriousness, though, I mean, I think he did a somewhat of a decent job with directing. I mean, again, I'm a fan of Bryan Singer's work, and it's very hard to compare the two. But I feel that it was almost as if I was watching two movies. The first half of the movie, very slow moving, you know, building up to the second half, but not many action shots. That's the best way to put it. The second half of the movie, all action. Not a moment to pause, not a moment to think. You're in the movie, you're watching the movie, it's happening. In the first half, a lot of silence, a lot of exposition. And again, I feel that that's almost, you know, that's Brett Ratner's work right there, because that, you wouldn't really find that too much in a Bryan Singer movie. He likes to spread his action out. Well, I think Ratner did more of a, you know, putting it all in the second half thing.
Oh, I'm looking forward to the DVD with hopefully some deleted scenes, because there were you had two storylines and they really weren't able to do to maybe delve into either one of them too much or just give them some sort of outcome. It just, you had the two storylines, they meet at the end, and that's where, you know, then that's where everybody gets to meet up afterwards. So it just, there were, I was enjoying the storyline with The Cure, I was enjoying the storyline with Dark Phoenix. Were things left out here or there that might have progressed nicely if they wanted to make a little bit of a longer movie? Sure. But I was still pleased with the outcome overall.
Now, this is not something that you want to see on a regular basis, right? A movie that's basically, you know, forced into production, done in 6 months, and, you know, put out there. Because obviously this is an exception to the rule here. I mean, if you did this with every single movie, you know, three quarters of the movies would be absolutely terrible, and you'd have a quarter that, you know, actually really did a decent job. X-Men 3 did a decent job here, but given more time to be produced, we might have seen more of those stories fleshed out, and you might have seen more of a well-polished movie.
Definitely. Either regular production in a film are so important to the quality of the film. When you rush something, you put in dire jeopardy the quality of the film as a whole, and I think the fact that the film did come out, it looked sharp. I mean, there was some cheesy effects, some effects that would have benefited from more time, like the Colossus stuff. But given the time frame they had to work with, which was pretty much imposed on them because Singer left, and then Matthew Vaughn left after he came on, I mean, there's really nothing they could do. And Fox has stated that X-Men is bigger than one person.
Yeah.
They weren't about to move their entire summer tentpole flick out of the most ideal spot of the summer, which obviously worked out very well for them, because one guy left, and they technically could make the movie in the time that they still had. And they did, and it worked out well for them. I just hope they don't see that now as a way to they can rush all of their movies, especially these comic book movies, and hope that they get the same results, because you're right, this is the exception, and we are very lucky that it didn't suck, because it could have very well been a train wreck.
All right, yeah, well, I mean, that I would certainly agree with, because, again, I would never want to see something like, you know, like a Spider-Man or something like that done in such a small frame, because Spider-Man's more of a story-driven sort of movie in the first place. X-Men is more about the action, and they did have very good action in this. I will give them that much.
Yes, they did.
Yes, indeed. Now, one thing also that got me, the effects in that first scene, in general, was so much better than I thought it was going to be, because that drew me into the movie right there. That very first scene with the de-aging they did, basically, they made Patrick Stewart look like Jean-Luc Picard again, which, you know, you hadn't seen him look that young in so long, and both Magneto and Professor Xavier looked stunning in there, and the effects of, you know, Jean Grey lifting everything, lifting all those cars up, and then you have the cameo.
The Stan Lee cameo.
And Chris Claremont. Chris Claremont was in that scene
cameos.
As well. Yes.
It's multiple cameos.
Oh, I did not know
Claremont,
that.
Both Claremont and Stan Lee are in the crowd there, and that was just stunning to me. Just to quickly ask this before we go back to the movie itself, they're thinking of doing, as one of the spinoffs, a Magneto movie. And they're saying that Ian McKellen will play Magneto in this movie, utilizing similar effects to what was done in the opening shot of this. Now, do you feel that these effects would actually be able to last an entire movie and, you know, not begin to look like effects and maybe, you know, start to grate on you after a while?
Depends on how many close-ups there are.
Okay. Well, again, yeah, close-ups do have to do a lot with it. That's true, because you can tell when something's a special effect. You can. And I think they call it like a digital brushing effect. That's what it is. It's not even actually like putting any makeup on whatsoever. It's all done in post.
Okay.
And again, if they decided to do like a Star Trek Next Generation movie 20 years from now with Patrick Stewart using this technology, I'm not quite sure if we'd actually be able to, you know, do that. You know, it's good for one scene. I don't know how good it is for the entire thing. But you guys enjoyed that first scene, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Did it draw you in, or did it take more than that to do it?
I was actually drawn in from the very moment the 20th Century Fox logo comes up, and the little X on Fox stayed on the screen for a split second longer, which they had done in the first two films, and I was scared to death they weren't going to do it again. That's just one of those small little things that Singer came up with and put it in there, and would have been forgotten or something, and when that little X kind of lingered for a second, I almost jumped out of my seat. I was ready. It was excellent.
Now let's talk about the relationships in this film. I mean, a lot of relationships between a lot of different characters changed in this film, and one that I'll mention right off the bat, it seemed at the end of X-Men 2, you sort of had a bit of a, I don't know, what's the best way to put it, sort of a bit of an understanding between Wolverine and Cyclops, and all of a sudden they hate each other again. Which was a bit jarring there for me. Did you guys feel that Wolverine and Cyclops had sort of come to understand each other by the end of X2? And did you feel it was off character at all for them to be warring at each other again like this?
I don't know that they were necessarily warring in their one scene. But I definitely feel at the end of X2 they were both in the same place. Or they both just lost someone and pain was brand new for the both of them. But I think Wolverine moved on, and Scott's still in that place, and Wolverine is now in a different place, so he can no longer empathize with Scott. So when you can no longer empathize with him, you can no longer, you know, find anything to like about him, then he's going to be a dick to him. Because it's not like he's not a dick to him either.
Well, that's certainly true. And, I mean, Cyclops in this was basically, I mean, it was almost like a complete turnaround for the character. I mean, you saw just absolutely how broken he was from Jean dying. I mean, his entire life fell apart. I mean, this was not the leader of the X-Men. This was just some guy that, you know, you expected to find, like, a random drunk in the middle of the street. Which, actually, I mean, like, you saw sort of, like, the taming of Wolverine and the feral nature of Cyclops. You know, it was the complete turnaround here.
A nice parallel to the first one, if you want to go ahead and give Ratner some sort of credit.
Well, yeah, definitely. Well, I'm not saying anything, you know, bad about Ratner, but I'm sure a lot of people are. And
not talking to you, talking to those people out there
okay.
who hate him for God knows what
reason. Well,
I never did anything.
I think
you made Rush Hour. What's so?
Yeah,
that's a good move.
I know. Well, I think it was.
He also made the Hannibal.
Red Dragon.
Thank you.
And Money, okay, and Money Talks, which is some of Charlie Sheen's best work.
Yes, and this broke all box office records for Friday, which also proves just how many people out there are willing to see a third X-Men movie, because people were saying, oh, no. I mean, because Bryan Singer's not doing it, nobody's going to show up. Everybody's going to hate this right off the bat. Well, you know what? The numbers don't lie, and right now the numbers are saying that people want to see X-Men 3.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that just shocked me completely. I was expecting it to do Batman numbers somewhere around 50. Mm-hmm. Doubled that.
Well, also, does that say something about Marvel and DC? I mean, does it say that people want to see Marvel movies more than they want to see DC movies?
I think it says more to the fact that X-Men is a fresh commodity and Batman was coming back. I think a Batman Begins sequel will probably do somewhere in the range of 80, and then if a third Batman movie came out, it would do somewhere in the range of 100, very similar to what the three X-Men movies did, because it was the first, no one really knew what to expect, you know, general public-wise. But I think Superman will probably open real big, just because it's Superman. I think average Joe Q doesn't really know much about the differences between Marvel and DC and what that means. They just know comic book. So Spider-Man, X-Men, Batman, Superman, it's all kind of one and the same for them.
Yeah.
I gotta say, man, do you live in an atrium? Because I like that bird noise in the background. That's good stuff.
Well, I got my window open. That might be
Oh,
me.
Okay.
Yeah, that's you.
Oh,
all right. That's not me. I was looking around and
Because Wally's got the AC on, I have the window open next to me, because Wally, it is just that comfortable and cool out.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Just come talk to me when it's freezing.
And yeah, I guess there are some birds flying.
I was just curious where that was coming from at first. I'm like, whoa.
They're very tranquil.
Yes, exactly. We're in a very relaxed mood here, talking about X-Men 3,
because right.
It didn't suck. It didn't suck.
No, it didn't. I thought, when I was saying about things looking back on after the fact, you were hit over the head a few times with the foreshadowing. When Xavier tells Storm, you'll be taking over when I'm gone, with this guy in the bed that's basically just a shell of a man, that, you know, would it be ethical if someone just inhabited his body? There were just things that, if you watched enough, or if you were really reading between the lines, then yeah, you probably would have known that these were going to happen within the same movie. This wasn't someone talking about something that would happen somewhere down the line. But it still surprised me, and not that I'm anything great to, you know, pick up on things, but if it kind of went over my head, then chances are it might have went over a few other people's, and that made it a little bit more surprising, I think, to the general public, or even my wife, because she really enjoyed it. She loves anything with Hugh Jackman, but she loved Wolverine scenes, and she really, really, really got a kick out of Kelsey Grammer.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was perfect, and I mean absolutely perfect casting. You could not have had anybody else playing Beast in this movie other than Kelsey Grammer, because he just proved this man is Beast. You know, I mean, he's got that personality down perfectly. The Oh My Stars and Garters, you know.
That I was so happy when they put that
How do
in.
You sell that line? How did he do that? I'm still in awe. I knew, I had a feeling they were going to say something to that effect, because that's his line, that's his thing, and you read it on paper, oh, okay. But that is the hokiest, cheesiest, worst line of dialogue, and he sells it, and you hear him say it, and you're like, oh snap.
And that's exactly what I said.
Well, like, I was sort of thinking that they would go the X-Men animated series route and just go, oh my, or something like that at one point, you know, sort of like emulate the George Takei for a little bit there, but... You know,
oh my, and then Storm looks down at her pants. Stars and
Oh my God. See, Wally, you just add something to the show right here, man.
And speaking of Storm, I'm glad her wig has gotten better as each movie's come out.
And I love the line that acknowledged it, too.
Yeah, I love what you've done with your hair. Yeah. Oh, man. And, you know, honestly, I like what they did with Beast, you know, not making him a regular, you know, just a regular old mutant, making him somebody that actually has power in the government, somebody who is the ambassador for mutant relations.
Yeah, that was nice, right. Well, and which is what Storm said, is that we have a president in the White House that accepts us, and, you know, as opposed to the... other president that was practically killed by Nightcrawler in the second movie. Yeah, okay, this is someone that, you know, yeah, we know there are different people out there. There are all types of people, shapes and sizes, and they're one of you. So, you know, it's okay if we're all hanging out together. So that was nice. I know DC did that with Black Lightning as, like, the Secretary of Education under President Luthor, but I don't know if Marvel's done anything like that as far. I'm trying to think.
Iron Man. Iron Man was Secretary of Defense for a short time.
Okay, right. Okay, yeah. Okay.
And, well, there was that short time also that Captain America was running for president.
Okay. Okay.
So,
you had to
but he was also an artist at Marvel Comics, so we won't bother with
that. Yeah, exactly. Well, now, also one thing that I liked, one of my favorite lines in the entire movie was when Beast finally put his X-Men uniform on, and he was like, I can't believe I used to fit into this thing. You know, it's like, you felt that, you know, it'd been a long time since he was a member of the team, that he was one of the originals, and that, you know... I like that, you know, even though they made changes with a lot of the characters, because obviously, you know, Iceman was a very different character in this than he was, obviously, in the comics. Angel, very different character than he was here, than he was in the comics. They weren't the originals, but the ones they chose to be originals, Beast, Cyclops, Jean Grey, those guys speak X-Men for me. And to have them be sort of like the three older statesmen of the X-Men was a very, very good choice on the part of the movie from the first movie until now. Excellent idea to keep those guys as the mainstays.
Could you include Storm?
You can include Storm in that, yeah. And right. I mean, she's proven herself also that, you know, she's been a leader in the comics, which is why I'm not surprised that she took that leadership role here.
All right.
And one thing.
No, go ahead.
Because you're talking about Beast in his old costume. This is something I didn't notice until. The third time I actually watched a movie, but when that suit that he puts on is actually an almost completely different design style than the current suits that they're wearing.
Yeah, it was like a little more grayish.
Yeah, and the X is, it's like a, there's a clear X on one of the bits of the team. It's kind of a goldish, you know, honing back to the old X-Men style of costumes and sort of showing some progression. And that's just one of those small little details that just really helps sells everything. It's not like he throws on an X uniform and says, oh, well, this used to want to suit me. No, this is an old X-Men uniform that, you know, was laying around that they don't even use that style anymore.
I'm glad that at least he didn't put on goggles. You know, that just makes me happy. You know, as long as he keeps those goggles off him, then it's all good for me. Dear God, Chris Claremont, what were you thinking? Anywho, that's quite possibly the worst Beast outfit ever, though. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? Back when Claremont first came back on the book and they had redesigns for everybody and Beast was wearing these crazy goggles for a while and the jacket.
I'm glad I missed
that. I'm glad you did, too.
I'll take goggled Beast over cat-like Beast any day.
Well, we'll have an argument on that some other day, but...
What about Mystique?
I was just going to say, Mystique... Of all the people to be depowered, hers was probably the most powerful because she was just so involved with, well, obviously, you know, as a part to later in the movie, which we'll talk about, but, I mean, she was the most powerful second in command to Magneto, and the fact that Magneto sort of just brushed her off to the side afterwards.
Yeah, just dismissive like that. I'm trying to think if actually that was really true to character. I mean, yeah, okay, so you're not a mutant, so now I don't want a damn thing to do with you, because I know that what I'm doing is so right that I can't even associate myself with the likes of you, even though we've had years of working together and you being there for me. I'm just going to dismiss you like that. I don't know. I mean, there was no compassion there. I mean, the only thing he didn't do was kill her.
Yeah, that's true.
Kind of the point, though. I mean, in this movie, more than any other movies, he's got a very true point. He is almost, you can almost say he's right up until the point that he rips up landmarks and throws them at people. But I mean, he is right. I mean, they're going to use the cure to, you know, as weapons. They're already on that slope. They're going to do that. He's right. You need to make sure you're aware that he's the villain. He's on the right side, technically, but he's still the bad guy, and he'll use people. Like he used Mystique, and I think it's very telling to his personality that you see him use this character like to the point where she feels like she's a personal confidant of his, and then the moment she is no longer useful to him, it's over, it's done.
She was dead to him at that point. I mean, she was almost as if she wasn't there, and which is why it was just such great poetic justice that, you know, the person who gives up their location is Mystique, and that great line, nothing like a woman scorned, you know? Yeah. Oh, man, that was great. And also, you knew that's in character for Mystique, because whenever she doesn't get her way, she's turning on everybody.
Yeah. And I noticed, though, especially, it was more prominent when, before the government knew of their location in the woods, it was after the Wolverine scene, and Magneto was talking to everybody out, and he's standing up on the rock, and Jean Grey is standing off to the side away from everybody else, but that's when I noticed that Magneto has a thing for redheads.
Oh, boy. Which is actually sort of interesting because people make comments about that than Professor Xavier before. So I guess maybe the tables have turned in the movies themselves. But that's interesting. So that's another part of Magneto's character that we're just going to have to, you know, look into. His personal preference in women is redheads.
And as far as that scene in the woods with Wolverine in the jungle, how do you think the fight scene went?
That was a lot of fun. That was definitely a lot of fun. And, well, before that even, with Multiple Man, beautiful use of Multiple Man there. I mean, even if you're using him as a villain, because he's been a villain, for a short time he was a villain in the Marvel Universe before. Perfect, perfect use of Multiple Man. He was even wearing his outfit, too. His current outfit, Next Factor, that's exactly what he was wearing in the movie, which was great for me, because his outfit in the comics now actually transfers over incredibly well to the movies, so I was glad to see that.
That look that he shoots Mystique as she's walking by as they pull him out.
Yes.
When he did that, that's one of the few times that I was alone, or there was only one or two people erupting with laughter and applause, because if you know Multiple Man, if you know Jamie Madrox, it's perfect, and it was no problem. I think the casting in this movie, top to bottom, is probably the best of the three, in the sense that every character they brought in is note perfect in some respect, with the exception of some of the villains. But like Kitty Pryde, Beast, Multiple Man, they're note perfect. I could see movies about these characters endlessly. They're that perfect.
And even though the costume wasn't the greatest, I did buy Vinnie Jones as Kane Marco.
True.
So at least a better helmet. The straps, the leather across, I can kind of buy that. He's a strong man or whatever, but the helmet I wasn't too thrilled
Don't
with.
You know who I am? I'm the Juggernaut, bitch!
My theater erupted.
Mine too.
I think it caught everyone by surprise. I knew, because there was a clip online that says, "Don't you know who I am?" And that's the end of the clip. And I'm like, okay, so they're going to kind of allude to that. Cute. I just couldn't. The fact that he's calling this girl who looks like she's 12 in real life.
Yeah.
A bitch.
it's just so. Well, that works because on the Juggernaut bitch, he's calling Jubilee a bitch. So, you know, that totally works. It's just a different 12-year-old this time around. Oh, man. Let's talk about Kitty Pryde for a bit, because this is the third person who's played Kitty Pryde in the X-Men movies. There was one person who played her in X-Men, then a different person who played her in X-Men 2, now a completely different person in X-Men 3. Were you happy with Kitty in this, or did you feel she was on character? Because I certainly did. She was that, you know, she was the youngest member of the X-Men. She was a regular member of the X-Men, and she felt like a regular member of the X-Men when she was out there.
You want to know an interesting tidbit of information about the three kitties?
Sure.
The three actresses they had play her are progressively younger in the movie. She's 14 in the first one, 16, 17 in the second one, and this character is 19. Or Ellen Page is 19 in the movie. But they look younger.
Yeah.
Like the 14-year-old looks older than Ellen Page looks now, and then the one in the middle is the one in the middle. I thought that was creepy. It's like she was de-aging, but she was getting older. Yet she was. They found it was weird. If you just put progression, the three of them. Now get back to talking about
secondary mutation.
Yes. She can phase and de-age.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's something that we don't know about her phasing powers, that they're slowly de-aging her. But no, I mean, what did you guys think about Kitty? I mean, again, I felt she was completely on par, and I felt that actually they couldn't have gotten a better person to play her, because that one fight scene with her and Juggernaut. Played out so beautifully, and the look on her face too. Like you could tell she was totally freaked out as this guy's, you know, going towards her. And when she called him dickhead, I'm like, oh wow. For some reason, I felt that was like totally in character for Kitty. What'd you guys think?
I agree. No, I thought that I was real happy with the outcome with the actress with her scenes, with her lines. Even the love triangle didn't feel forced to me at all. I was real happy with Kitty in general.
Well, that's something that the movies get to do too. They get to pick and choose, you know, what the love triangles are going to be. And you know what? In this one, it really did work. I mean, Iceman and Rogue in the comics would never work. In the movies, it does. Similarly, Iceman and Kitty Pryde in the movies really works. In the comics, I would never want to see it.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's all part of the movie medium, too, because these are different characters than the ones that we know. Well, were there any qualms at all with the love triangle, or did you enjoy it?
No, I actually really, really liked it, because it sort of advanced these characters more towards what they are like in the comic books. With Bobby, now this is his second girl in as many movies. Say in the next one they bring in, you know, Lorna, and then he's finally, you know, lustful after her. And you would then believe that he's the kind of guy that everyone would think is just, you know, a ladies' man, sort of foolish, young, always looking for the nicest piece of tail in an X-Men uniform at the time. It's slowly but surely bringing him to what we know him as at the comic books. And then the same with Kitty to a certain respect. I mean, her character starts out very much the innocent, youngest, you know, she doesn't have anyone. And then she has this, I don't even want to call it a relationship with Bobby. He was just, you know, being nice to her because she had no one. I mean, albeit he should have, you know, not left Rogue alone while he was going to be nice with another age-appropriate woman. But it's interesting. I like it.
Well,
I could talk in circles all day, but yeah.
Well, Rogue also, I mean, that was a major shift for her character. You know, basically, I mean, I felt that she had sort of come to terms with it in the second movie, but basically, you know, she jumps and completely jumps the opportunity for a cure and actually accepts it. But I will guarantee you that if they do make an X-Men 4, which I'm sure they probably will, that halfway through X-Men 4, all these mutants that lost their powers will be getting them back. Because people forget, Leech, when you're around him, your powers go away. But as soon as you leave him, they come back. And any serum that's based off of his powers, I'm sure, is probably only going to be temporary or will probably only last for a certain amount of time before you need to either take the serum again or it'll just wear off. So I wouldn't be surprised if that happens with Rogue, and that would actually be an interesting plot twist if they do make a 4. If she basically, you know, reenacts what happens to her in the comics, she's kissing somebody and all of a sudden, you know, completely takes his life.
Well, you saw the final scene before the credits rolled. So it obviously looks that, you know, I don't think it has to do with age, I don't think it has to do with how powerful you are when your mutant powers are at their fullest, but, you know, Magneto was moving a chess piece at the end of the movie. And he was hit with 4 needles.
Jeez. That's true, yeah. And also, well, we'll get to the end and the bonus scene. Also, I'm sure everybody stuck around until the end, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Just making sure because that last scene made the entire thing for me. Let's see. Anybody have any negatives about the movie before we move on to the fight scenes and all that?
Not really using everybody that they could have used. I am a Cyclops fan. I'm not a fan of Cyclops in the movie because I really, as much as Marsden is a good enough actor, I think he was great in The Notebook. I mean, he's done things that I've seen him in that aren't horrible. I don't know if, you know, he's a great Scott Summers. So, I mean, he was always kind of, except in the first movie, like Wally said, he was always kind of like a weak character to me, and it wasn't the way I wanted to see Cyclops being one of my favorite X-Men. So just the fact that these actors that were, you know, I was bummed that there was no Nightcrawler, and Renee noticed that too because she was kind of looking forward to seeing him. The lack of Cyclops, the fact that when we want to, you know, when we want to take somebody out of a movie, we're just going to kill him. You know, we're going to kill Cyclops, we're going to kill, and yeah, okay, you know, we didn't see him die on screen, but okay, we're going to write Cyclops out of the movie, we're getting rid of Professor X, we're just, you know, when we're done with you, you're getting killed off in a movie. It's like the death of Green Goblin or the death of Doc Ock. It's like, you know, instead of actually just putting them away somewhere or having them go away or writing them, just have them not die. I would like to see somebody not die. That would make me happy. So I guess just these deaths where I could see the why they were in the movie, and yeah, they did have an impact, but I didn't want to see it, so that was a negative to me.
Well, what about you, Wally?
I was definitely a little disappointed with the fact that we only had literally like half a sentence from Moira MacTaggert. She's always been my favorite non-mutant character amongst the X-Men as far as the good guys go. And I was really excited. They got this real actress, Olivia Williams, perfect for the role. And, you know, I figured, hey, real actress, real part. But unfortunately, that didn't come. I mean, she had 2 scenes technically, but I mean, just the way she had one word that she really rolled her R in that really thick accent. I was.
Well, I will guarantee you that come X-Men 4. If they make it, which I'm sure they will, because even though it's called The Last Stand, it's not going to be the last X-Men movie, because you could tell by the amount of money that they're making off of this, they're going to make more. I will guarantee you that Moira MacTaggert will be in it more, and we'll see Banshee. Because if we don't see Banshee, okay, if there's Moira and no Banshee, I'm going to be very annoyed. Okay, because they're almost like synonymous for me. You know, one goes with the other. Even if they don't have a relationship, I want to at least see Banshee on Muir Island, just at least once.
He's definitely one of the last big, important characters they could bring in, which they're saving several. I mean, you have Havoc, Gambit, and Banshee. A couple of these guys that have been prominent X-Men in the past. Just so you can have some sort of anchor with these newer movies. They're not all supporting pieces. So, I mean, I definitely agree with you 100%. Moira, that's why they get an actress like Olivia Williams, because you don't want to... I mean, you want to have a good actress when she does eventually get a good part. And with a... You have to have Banshee. You're right. I mean, if they don't have Banshee, it's a major misstep.
I would definitely agree with that. My major error that I would say in the movie... I absolutely hated that token mutant that they had in there with the speed, who could, you know, find the powers of every mutant and, you know, could, like, sense every mutant's abilities before, you know, just by walking into the room. First of all, they could have went with so many mutants from the Marvel comics, okay? And they go with this almost like Mary Sue character to me that had way too much power, you know, that... felt as if she really didn't belong there. Now, I understand. If you want to go for a speedster, put Quicksilver in there. He is the speedster mutant. We all know that. Also, Psylocke. Psylocke was billed to be in this movie. She had no lines. She was only in the background. And we barely ever saw her.
But you know who that was? The speedster. The one you're talking about, the one who had the knockdown drag out with Storm. You know who she was?
Who was it?
Callista.
Really? Okay, yes. Well that makes it even worse for me. Oh my god.
And the powers are actually Caliban. From the comics.
Yeah, with finding the mutant, right? Yeah. I guess they just wanted to have that Storm Callisto fight.
I guess.
I think the memo that Ratner got was they said they're gonna have the Morlocks in the film, but the S was left off, so Morlocks.
So we just got everybody.
I also really wanted Leech to be green with a beanie, but that's just me. Because
the only one other negative is the fact that Warren Worthington III is in it for like 2.5 scenes. I was expecting a little bit more.
They got a great guy to play him too.
And he didn't be an X-Men, but yes, they did. They did. It really was kind of a waste. I mean, he didn't have to join the team. He didn't have to. But I mean. He was in, I mean, the character, Ben Foster was in there for 2 scenes practically, but I mean, you had the little kid in the beginning when cutting his feathers off, trying to get rid of the wings, and then you see him later, years later, and he's grown, and I mean, it was neat with the way they had the harness with the wings, and then he wore the trench coat over it so that, you know, like Captain America's shield, you won't be able to tell what he's got under there, but... I would have liked to have seen more
Angel. I would have liked to see more Angel as well, because, again, yet another person that they build to be, you know, like one of the center points of the film, and you see him, like, 3 times, you know, and that's not really too much there. I guess the only other bad point that I'm going to have to say is just how all over the map they had Jean Grey. And, again, understandable, because she was very unstable in the movie, but I felt almost as if she was almost too unstable, if that makes sense. Like... She's supposed to have 2 clear-cut personalities, you know? The Jean Grey personality and the Phoenix personality. And you had some scenes where it was like, you know, both at once, or one seemed to be a bit too much and, you know, not nearly as centered as I would have liked to have seen. You know, it really, really didn't feel proper to me. And one other thing, come on, add some fire to her. You know, when she's doing her Phoenix powers, because they had a bit of a glow, they had a bit of an orangish glow, I guess. But I really wanted to see at least some fire, because she's the freaking Phoenix. You know, with the Phoenix without fire just really doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. But again,
I agree completely with the lack of fire, but the effect that they did use for when she's using her powers, I thought was brilliant for the movie verse. The whole her face. It's all veiny and dark, and her eyes go black, and that was really, really disturbing, almost, like the first time you saw that.
Were you thinking that this is actually her manifesting her powers, or that something was possessing her? Because it could be either one.
It really could be, but I think the way I interpret it, and actually with your problem with the fact that she's all over the map, I interpret it sort of differently in the film, because the mental blocks were in place... when Xavier refers to the fact that she had developed split personality. And now that those blocks are gone, both of these personalities are now melding into one, and it's going to cause, you know, sometimes one is very prominent, sometimes the other isn't. And the fact that the normal Jean is probably very submissive compared to the Phoenix entity, it would make sense for me that you would see that a little more, but you would also at times see the the Phoenix, like whenever Scott was mentioned with her, the Jean came right up, because that's the strongest emotional feelings she had, put it right up at the top. And then when you say the Professor, the Phoenix comes out, and you're just like, that's the bastard that locked me up in, you know, in the brains. You know, I'm Phoenix again.
Well, no, that's Juggernaut's line. All right, let's wrap things towards the end of the movie here. Now, the fight scene at the end, okay? That fight scene that basically took about, you know, half hour to 45 minutes at the end there, with the whole Golden Gate Bridge and everything, stunning. Stunning's the only word for it, because that part, again, it was almost like two movies to me. This second half of the movie, which was like movie two to me, was the movie I came to see. Absolutely perfect action, you know, Wolverine going nuts, Fastball Special number two, Colossus, you know, ironing up and, you know, doing his whole thing, Kitty all over the map, you get to see Iron Man, Iceman icing up, which was just great, and it felt like an X-Men fight. It was X-Men versus Brotherhood of Evil Mutants again.
Yeah, I was glad to see Pyro get his ass kicked, even if it was just
hell dead, yeah.
But I was though half expecting, you know, Wolverine's telling the X-Men to stand the line, and I was half expecting the soldiers to just shoot him in the back and cure him all.
You know, that honestly, I was half expecting that as well, but I'm glad it didn't happen, because
oh, yeah.
Because a powerless Wolverine is not a good Wolverine.
No.
Although I do like how he proved how, okay, and this is, you know, this is just great for me also, when he had that fight with the guy who, I guess, what was the name of that guy from X-Men Evolution? Because I guess that's who that was supposed to be. Spike? Okay. When he had that fight with Spike, and the Bone Claw goes in, and, you know, he pulls it out, proved once again that adamantium is better than Bone Claw.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, man. Bone Claw Wolverine. Somebody shoot me. That was just bad. But
you know what? I actually have rationalized that in my head, though, Bone Claw Wolverine.
Really?
That makes sense to me, because the way it was told to me, it was either at a comic shop when it was happening or something, is that when the adamantium was in his skin, Wolverine's regenerative abilities are so great that his body has adapted to the fact that he has claws.
True.
Now. So when the claws are removed, the body feels and thinks it should have claws, so therefore it regenerates the claws the only way it knows how, and that is bone.
Okay.
And that's how I've rationalized it through all these years. I agree completely. It's the stupidest thing in the world. But I can rationalize
and
it.
And suddenly it all makes sense.
Yes.
You are stupid. I'm smart.
It's a comic book. It has to be
true. Oh, yes, definitely. What did you guys think of the fight scene?
Loved it.
Amazing, right?
It was the X-Men fight scene I've been waiting to see since.
Yeah,
I would agree with that.
It's almost like it did take three movies to build up to this.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, it would have been nice if you had more X-Men on the side of good fighting. But for what we had,
best fight scene since the Statue of Liberty, definitely. I mean, since the Statue of Liberty and X-Men 1, this is the best damn fight scene in X-Men movie history, definitely, without a doubt. Because you had everybody in there, you know, every mutant you could possibly think of, all stuffed in there. You've got Juggernaut going crazy, which was, again, I love seeing Juggernaut freak out. I love him, you know, just, like, running all over the place and, you know, smashing through walls and doing the whole Hulk thing. That's Juggernaut for me. Magneto also. I mean, that last scene where they fake out Magneto and stick him with the needles, and just the look on the X-Men's face, too, knowing that they needed to stoop to the level and use the weapons, it's just, wow.
I have a question for you, though. When they bring the bridge down, you see there's the family towards the front of the bridge in their car, and they're pinned in between two other cars because Magneto's shuffling things around, so they can't leave, and they're stuck there while Magneto brings the bridge and all that jazz. And then right before they walk in, the mom locks the door, and funny moment. Okay, now we're going to, you know, blow stuff up. They never resolve whether or not they left the car. And the first thing I thought when Magneto starts throwing the cars is, well, wait a minute. Is Pyro torching this innocent family that's just sitting there? It's a meaningless thought, but it evilizes them a whole lot more, because Magneto knows they're there. He, you know, smirked when he saw them, and at first I thought, that's kind of weird. Oh, wait, he smirked because he knows he's going to torch them to death
and throw
them at people.
It fits also because Magneto decided to go ahead and crush the convoy that was transporting Mystique and Madrox and the Juggernaut. He completely crushed these cars as they were driving towards
him. You know what? Wow, yeah. Huh.
And that was amazing, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, that scene was
matter,
awesome.
The matter-of-fact look on his face when he just crushes these cards and shoves them aside. And then, you know, I mean, that rivals the iron in the blood scene in X-Men 2 as far as just Magneto being Magneto.
And you want to talk about, you know, people being people, Phoenix being Phoenix, completely ripping to shreds everybody. And, I mean, she did it to Professor X earlier on in the movie, but doing it to everybody. It's just, wow, that's Phoenix going nuts.
She was literally turning gravity upside down at one point with the water just shooting up. It was that bit was some of the most beautiful action stuff I've seen in a long time. And the score right there, John Powell's music, was intense and just perfect and amazing. It's definitely one of my favorite scores in a long time. For this movie.
I would agree with that 100%. Any final thoughts from anybody out there? Go see it. If you haven't seen it. Oh, well, actually, one more thing before we do actually do the final thoughts. All right, the two end scenes in the movie, obviously, one with Magneto and then one with Professor Xavier, which, again, makes sense to have, you know, an end scene with one side and an end scene with the other. How amazing was that to see, you know, basically a broken Magneto sitting there with the chess pieces trying to get his powers working again, and then you see just that little move, just a little bit, proving that he is still Magneto in at least one way.
It was great. It's just the parallel, the fact that he's sitting there playing chess by himself, lamenting the fact that he has gone so far off the deep end that his cause is ruined and his best friend is dead. And all he's done is cause the life of mutants greater harm, because now I'm sure mutant relations goes a whole lot south after what happens. It's kind of nice and rosy at the beginning of the movie, but by the time they're at the end of the movie, I'm sure they're right back where they started, in the sense that people hate mutants again. So it's just a really nice parallel between the first movie, where there's the meeting of the minds at the very beginning, the first time you meet both characters, where you can feel there's a camaraderie between them, yet they're at odds. And now at the end, when Magneto has gone his way so far, he's been so wrong, yet when he thought he was so right, and it's caused so much death and all this stuff, he's just sitting there looking like he's reflecting on all that. It was just...
Well, it makes me think, if there is an X-Men 4, maybe we'll see that storyline that we saw back in the 80s with a reformed Magneto versus, you know, the U.S. government and with the X-Men protecting him.
I wouldn't be surprised, although I also wouldn't be surprised if they just don't use Magneto again. I think it would be very fitting to end it that way. Maybe he comes in, I mean, and I actually have whole great theories about what the next X-Men trilogy could and should be, and he definitely has a place in all that, but I think it fits very well ending the way it ends. Maybe he goes and becomes a teacher at the Institute, because they need staff, and they could hide him. I mean, he can, you know, always stay on ground.
Well, that place is huge also. I mean, that place has more, you know, sub-basements than anybody, so they could certainly hide him, and they wouldn't even remember that he's there.
X-Men 6 comes around, but wait a minute. Didn't we take Magneto in at some point in time?
Then they go down there and they see, like, his emaciated skeleton. They're like, God damn it.
Still got the helmet
on, though. Of course,
because
that helmet just makes him Magneto. But the final end scene, okay, with on Muir Island with Moira, just how fitting was that to have, like, the comic book? I mean, again, that would only happen in the comic books, too. You know, with you know, him still somehow being alive. That's just amazing.
I'd be very interested to see how they, you know, go about it. Whether or not they're going to make it so he's Xavier again, or if they're going to have this sort of body that's something different with Xavier's voice and mind and thoughts and all that stuff. It definitely makes me... I mean, he could stay in a wheelchair, thankfully.
See, I need him to be Xavier again because, God damn it, he's Patrick Stewart.
Well, he could be Xavier in the sense that he's in this mind and he's in this decapitate... Not decapitate. You know, in the state where he can't do anything, so he converses with people mentally, and you see Patrick Stewart there as Professor Xavier, as opposed to, you know, him coming back and all of a sudden this other person has changed and looks just like...
That's true. David, that? I mean...
Or plastic
Oh,
surgery.
Yeah, well... Do you think this is the last we see of Patrick Stewart as Professor Xavier? Do you think it'll be, like, some other random dude, some black dude, you know, in a wheelchair? Or, I mean, will they make it, you know, Patrick Stewart, Professor Xavier again?
I would see... No, I don't. I don't think we'd see somebody else. I hope not.
So you think they'll go the plastic surgery route and basically, you know, make him look like Xavier again?
You know what? No, you're probably right. No, I mean, after I said it out loud and, you know, what I want and what might actually make more sense, it might just be easier to... I could see the voice being Stewart's, but no, I could see somebody else doing the acting.
Or maybe he can even have a setup where his body is actually in the basement of the Institute, but he can still project himself mentally out there, and that projection could be...
To me, my X-Men.
That's right, yeah.
And it's just a big floating head of Patrick Stewart sort of wandering in the halls, popping in on students.
Oh, God, MODOK, dear God.
Or it's someone messes with him and so he looks like Sugar Man or something, the little arms coming up at the top of his head.
Well,
like all that X-Men are giggling.
That's the first time I've heard the word Sugar Man in a very, very long time. David, we were wondering if maybe in the next movie we might see... Magneto switch sides, perhaps on the side of the X-Men now. Maybe the X-Men protecting him, obviously with the rest of the government completely after him, now that he obviously is a mutant again. Where else is he going to find safe haven?
Yeah, and they would take him in because that's who they are, but he would still be using them. I don't see a change of heart. I don't see him being a teacher like he did 10 years ago for the New Mutants.
Okay. 20 years ago, actually, see, now, isn't it?
You're right, yes, yeah.
You guys are
old. You know what?
I'm 22. What the hell are you talking about, man?
Okay, David's old.
Yes, I am. Thank you. But, you know, I could see him going there to, you know, be safe for Sanctuary, but I don't see a change of heart. I don't see him going, oh my God, you guys, you've always been right. I've seen the error of my ways. It ain't going to happen.
Age of Apocalypse Magneto. No, I doubt it'll be that, yeah.
You can have a relationship with
Yeah, again.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. This time I'll give you more than my hair.
Oh, dear God, make it stop. Holy crap.
You have a little kid.
Oh, yeah. I really want to see Magneto with, like, a 17-year-old. God. Jeez. You know... This is territory no podcast should go.
No, so moving right along.
Exactly. Let's have some final thoughts on the movie, and we'll wrap things up for today. We'll save our quarter bins and all that for next week, as we're running long as always. So let's get some final thoughts. Wally, you first.
Definitely a movie worthy of the X-Men name. Definitely worthy of the two previous movies. And it definitely sets it up as a trilogy that's really important to the comic book, you know, world. I mean, it's a trilogy of movies, comic book related movies, that were successful, well made, critically accepted, which is good movies. And this, along with Spider-Man, because I'm sure Spider-Man 3 is going to be the same way as Spider-Man 1 and 2. And these are two trilogies that show that this is an actual thing you can do in film now. It's not a fad. It's not a, you know, it's a whole subgenre that is just going to create amazing stuff in the future. So, it's important in that respect. It's an important film. I bet you never hear anyone say that. This is an important film.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, Rush Hour is a very important film also. Well, yeah, no, I mean, it had relations. It had friendship between the African-American and the Japanese and the Chinese and the Asian and the everybody.
The Asian, yes.
And how the white people didn't trust
exactly.
either of them.
That's yes. Right. Final thoughts from you, David.
Like I said, go see it. I thought it did a really nice job of capping the three movies as far as the main stars and the main characters, and it definitely made a path, paved the way for for lack of a better term, for the New Mutants to show up. And I could see Storm or anybody from the original movies making a cameo as a professor, as an instructor, something like that. But I could see the focus being done on the other mutants, and it would be interesting because of the work they've done in these three movies. So it's these first three made a great franchise. I was shocked and awed at a lot of scenes in this third movie. It was it was a really good story. It was told well, and I really have no major complaints. So just go see it.
My comment, basically, I'll wrap it up with this. I think it was very fitting that this movie included stories from two of the best X-Men writers of the past 30 years, Chris Claremont and Joss Whedon, inside of this very movie. They had the Joss Whedon storyline of The Cure, and they had the Chris Claremont storyline of The Phoenix, all wrapped up into one package, and Joss Whedon finally saw an X-Men movie that, even though he wasn't a part of it, referenced his work, as opposed to the one "you're a dick" line in the first X-Men. So,
be fair, Joss Whedon wrote the line, you know what happens to a toad when it's struck by lightning? Everything else.
Yeah.
You gotta give, you have, I'm sorry, Joss, I love you, you're a great guy, but you did write
that's
that line.
That's true.
And that's
That's true. So,
that's a everybody chill line. That's how bad it is.
Oh, God. Well, at least it's not as bad as anything in Catwoman, that much I'll say.
So the common thread,
yes,
is Holly Berry.
X-Men 3, very, very good. I say, let's bring on Superman Returns and Spider-Man 3, because I'm ready to see what else comic book movies can get out there. There you go. I think that pretty much wraps it up nicely. What do you think?
So are these final thoughts?
I do believe these are the final thoughts of the final thoughts. Wally, I do believe we have you by a stranglehold.
It's the other way around.
I wish you could quit me. And by the way, Brokeback Mutant, classic.
Oh. If you guys want to listen a great or read a great Brokeback X-Men story, I wrote a small little slash Blob and Iceman.
Oh dear God!
Story for awards, which featured the brilliant line, "Nobody can move the Blob."
Oh my God!
I'll dig it up and post it on the Comic-Con.
I think we have a winner.
Oh, everyone now has a reason.
Hey, well, there's another reason also. There will only be one episode this week. I'm going to go back to this upcoming week because I'm going to be out of town yet again a week from this upcoming Sunday for yet another anime convention. After that, I'll be here, I promise. But, David, once again, thank you for joining us. And, Wally, thanks for joining us on Comic-Time.
Always.
Thank you very much. You can find us over at the Comic Geek Speak forums. You can find us there. The link will be on the main page over at speakgeekspeak.com/comic timing. Don't forget to vote for us on Podcast Alley. A link will be in the show notes and also on the side of the Comic Timing page. Also want to remind you all that if you want to send us an email, you can do so over at comictiming@gmail.com. And we are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network over at comicspodcast.com. And that pretty much wraps it up here. So for David, for Wally, I'm Ian Huddesy, reminding you that there's always time for comics. I'm Batman.
Yeah, I'm the goddamn Batman.
Watch out, or Papa Spank.
Did your rubber suit have nipples?
Wouldn't you like to know?
Oh, dear God. What have I started?
Uh-huh.
Oh, man. All right.
May not have nipples, but the codpiece is pretty full.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Just like Brandon Ralph needed it, you know.
No, we're not even going there. No,
exactly.
No. Let's rein it in right now.
You know, I know a guy who knows a guy who told me that it really wasn't necessary.
Oh, my God.